Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the L.A. Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And I love Lila Jones. You can do it right at the second we start.
Well, we need to start right on time. Tonight we're going to have our guest, George Dixon, and he has invited a special guest to be on with us, whose name is Peter Moon. And Peter is a publisher as well as author himself. And he has two new books out, one, the Montauk Book of the Living, which was just released, and also he has published a very interesting book called Transylvania Sunrise, and that is written with him and Radu Sinemar, who is a Romanian. Now, George has all the info on Peter Moon and his books, and I think George is with us.
Yeah, hang on 1 second. Hi, George.
Well, how are you doing? Good evening, folks.
How are you?
Good evening. Did you hear me introduce that?
Yes, I did. I caught the tail end of it. And I expect Peter to be calling in any time now.
Right this minute. I just thought you might want to introduce your friend for us.
Put him on.
More.
Well, let me, of course, you mentioned the two books, but okay. I've known Peter for a number of years. And him and I have talked extensively over the Montauk Project and the many, many books that he's written and co-written with Preston Nichols. And it's a fascinating saga, and Peter has been able to bring a lot of that out, and I think it's the way he writes, you're able to understand him very easily. And, I can't wait for Vincent to or Peter to tell us about his latest work, which I found interesting. I read it last week, and that is Transylvania Sunrise.
Peter is with us right now. Good evening and welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Good. Well,
hi, Peter.
We're very pleased to have you. And tonight we're talking about two of your books, Transylvania Sunrise, which was written with Radu Sinemar, and your other new release, Montauk, The Book of the Living. Both look to be very fascinating, and I know George had brought Transylvania Sunrise to our show one night, and when he was out having a smoke, I had a very long peek at it, so I was very interested.
He had the smoke with me, so we were like, but we reviewed the information that you gave us, and I as well, and we've also read a number of your other books, and we've had you on our program about a year ago when you came out with Spandau Mystery, I believe it was.
Right.
First of all, Peter, for our internet listeners, tell us a little bit about yourself and who you are.
Yeah, just a background.
Little.
Okay, I'll give you. I grew up in California, and I, you know, at the age of 18, I got involved in the movement, you know, as Scientology.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, in some ways, it was a distraction. In some ways, it was a completely vital part of my evolution as a person, because what we got involved in there at the higher levels is what they now use as the remote viewing technology.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the most obscure things that's ever covered or talked about when one gets to the subject of Scientology and all the bias against it, some of it quite understandable. It's a very big trigger in our society right now with all the stuff, but that's really beside the point. I was never too interested in the flack that goes with it, but just sort of the core principles involved. Now, those became an integral part of my understanding from my own viewpoint of the human spirit, and we studied implantation, which is now a household word in this day and age, but back in the 70s when I got exposed to it, you know, nobody talked about implants back then.
Right.
And so I had an understanding of that, and of course when I met Preston Nichols after moving to Long Island, leaving the Scientology movement in 1983, 7 years later, I met Preston, and he was a living testament to so many things of the principles that I'd learned in that organization as far as implantation and whatnot of human beings and manipulation of souls, which is what the Montauk Project was all about. And I think if there was anything that L. Ron Hubbard underestimated was that this stuff was going on right, you know, in the backyard of planet Earth, which he did not really state that it was going on that level. I don't think he was aware of it. He said it went on off planet.
How did Ron Hubbard know that it was going on off planet?
Oh, well, that would just be, you know, his own arguably telepathic abilities or remote viewing abilities and his study of case histories of people that he had counseled. You know, it would be a combination of those things.
Okay.
He wasn't playing with the same deck of cards that the average human being was. Of course, he had a near-death experience in, I think it was 1938, where he went out of body and got all the answers of the world downloaded to him.
Oh, wow.
You know, L. Ron Hubbard, did he follow much time travel or the understanding of time manipulating or going into the future, into the past?
You know, he didn't focus on that. He had his moments, I suppose. I remember sitting in their, you know, on the ship. I remember in my early days at the Sea Organization, studying in the ship, and he had these bulletins that he'd written about time, the time track. And he had a pretty good beat on it. Of course, I remember reading about time and wanting to learn more, but that really was sort of just a back section of what we were studying. It was not in that particular course. It was not, you know, the grit. So I'd say that he talked about matter, energy, space, and time being one thing. He didn't focus on time except as it related to the, you know, an individual's encounter with what he called engrams that screw him up on the time track. It was more from a therapy basis than, say, some of the neato whiz-bang stuff you get into with Montauk, if it can even be called that.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, Peter, you have a extremely interesting background, and that brings us to Transylvanian Sunrise. Now, this book was written by Radu Sinemar, who was...
Radu. We call it in English, we'll say Radu Sinemar. In Romanian, they will say Radu, Radu Sinemar. But we call him Radu Sinemar.
Okay, and he's a Romanian operative, and... From what I've read about your book, you met him through Dr. Anderson. Now, tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, well, that's only partially true. I met him through my involvement with David Anderson. Of course, David Anderson is a time travel scientist who actually knows how to control or manipulate time on a small scale compared to Montauk, because he developed this technology from his days in the Air Force when satellites were moving out several meters a year in space, and he was put on this project to create a space-time module to be able to manipulate the field and warp the energy using the special theory of relativity by Einstein, and he created a mathematical model to be able to maintain our satellites in outer space working for the Air Force. Now, when he finished with the Air Force and retired, he patented the algorithms which were necessary to maintain these satellites, and he created the Time Travel Research Center, and this was a corporation that existed in the 90s, and he had that in full swing. He was using those theories to manipulate time on a smaller scale, at that time the size of a soccer ball, where he could keep slow time down or speed it up, and he had a lot of investment from the medical community because they could slow down organ decay. So, you know, this was for transplants. So it was very interested in, and he had a facility on Long Island, one in Albuquerque, and one in Romania. Now, he had this in 1999, on August 11th, at the date of the solar eclipse, he came into our meeting that we had on Long Island, which George would attend periodically. I don't think George was there that night, but we had David came in and introduced himself at the end of the meeting to me. He listened to Preston's lecture, who was doing most, if not all, of the talking that night, and introduced himself to me and said he would like to dialogue with me. He took me out to lunch a week later, and we became friends, and he explained some of the things I just told you. He had just been back from Romania at that time. He was setting up a charitable foundation, which is called the World Genesis Foundation. You can find it on the web. That's his foundation to help Romanian artists, writers, and scientists. You know, he doesn't want anybody, and it's branched out to other countries now, like Thailand, and the Philippines. This is so that no youth in the world will not have opportunity. And, of course, in Romania, he was attending a conference called Atlanticron, and that was in 1999, and he was scrutinized by the government quite severely. They said, what the heck is this guy doing here? A friend came to his rescue, or somebody who became his friend, who was the sponsor of the event, and he sort of cleared David's name with the government, so David's able to function there freely, and he has still has an office there to this day. I really don't know about the office, but he told me at that time that Romanians have the best mathematicians in the world, and he uses that center as a theoretical think tank for his time travel research, which is very branched and divided, segmented, so not all the other arms don't know what all the other arms are doing, because that's how he keeps his technology proprietary.
So David Anderson, what I guess is a mathematical genius.
Yeah, to say the least, yes.
And a businessman that had enough foresight to patent some of these things that he developed with the military.
Right.
He has government connections. He's a former military person, a mathematical genius, and an adventurer too, I guess.
Yeah, and he's he's a really humble person, a very nice person, but he's going to be in a cloak of mystery. That's mm-hmm. just the way he is, and he just kind of appears. And now I've seen him in the last 2 years in Romania. He lives in Rochester,
mm-hmm.
New York, but he's threatened to come visit me in a couple of weeks. I say threatened jokingly, like. Maybe he'll appear, maybe he won't. I think he will.
Now, in Romania, so he set you up to get to Romania, and you connected with Radu Sinemar.
Let me explain how that happened, if I may.
Sure.
In 2003, he came to me and said that, he had to shut down the research center in Long Island because of pressure. After 9/11, there was a lot of stress with the government and stuff like that. And a friend in Romania had actually come to visit his time travel research center on Long Island. And I learned this not from David, but from his friend in Romania, who came and he was about to visit the center. He was actually on Long Island, and then 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm.
And they put such rigid security on everything that he was not allowed to visit the center. So David had to go overseas. He called me to his apartment and said that he had to go to Moscow, and he couldn't say where he was going other than to Moscow, and he didn't feel good about it. Because, when you're in the military and you have all the expertise he has, which includes nuclear weapons, they can tag you anytime they want.
Right.
So they tagged him. I determined from a friend that he was in Pakistan right after 9/11. From the email he sent me to reassure me that he was okay, because he wasn't sure. He wanted me to make a fuss. Well, he came back, and he had all sorts of security problems with his research center. He was forced out of that business and went to work for Bosch up in Rochester, a German defense contractor. It's our defense contractor in America. It's a German company. And they anyway, he said, you can have what's left of my research center in terms of the books and library. He was collecting, trying to make a time travel museum. And so he gave me that stuff, and Preston Nichols and I went up there and got this stuff, came back to, Long Island, and he said, I won't be able to work with you for another 5 years. To the day, 5 years, he contacted me and invited me back to Romania. But something had happened previously. I think he had arranged, or I don't know how it happened, but I was solicited to have my books published in Romania by a publication house that was come into being because it published Radu's book. And then when they published my books, they asked me if I'd publish their books. I began a prolonged negotiation to do that. It took about 3 months. And when I finally had the agreement, David had emailed me like within a few days saying, you want to come to Romania? We'll pay for you and somebody else. And you can come and speak at our conference. And so that renewed our friendship and our relationship, which was 5 years to the day, coincidentally. And I then had at that time read the book. It took me a year to prepare it and publish it for various reasons, which didn't have to do with reading it. And I've read the book about six times, including the proofreading. And, of course, that's kind of how it happened. How the association is between David and Radu Sinemar is very mysterious, because what I found out last year in Romania, and I wanted to find out, I found out that in a audio CD Radu gave to me that he did not know David. He says, I would like to meet David. And David said, sure. Well, he says, it's funny you say that, because people have told me I know Radu. Now, I don't know. Why do they tell him he knows Radu? One of his friends suggested to me that he gets emails from Radu under a different name. He knows him by email. But I don't know. Sometimes when you ask David questions, he just bypasses, because it's like he can't talk about it. So I don't press him. That's one reason I've been able to get along with him, because I don't, you know, ask him a lot of stupid questions. I'll ask him one occasionally, or which might be, you know, not welcome. And he either doesn't know the answer or doesn't answer. So, but I don't know what the connection is there, except that there is a mysterious connection between the two. To answer your question.
Talk a little bit about the Sphinx that's located in the mountains of Romania. That's what this book is about.
Well, it's yes, and of course that was the place I visited last year in the Bucegi Mountains of Romania, which is right on the border of Transylvania. There is this up above the tree line. You take a cable car to get up there, and it's just beautiful. This whole area, there's these big stones. One of them is called Babel. It's got a fence around it. It's like a national monument, as is the Sphinx. And although the Sphinx is not cordoned off, people climb it. They're not supposed to, but they climb it. And from the back, it looks just like a rock. When you get to the side, you see a profile of a man on the left profile. When I went around to the right side, I noticed that there was the profile of a cat on the other side. It is not as glaringly obvious, and it becomes very obvious when you put the telescopic lens on it. And, you know, from the video camera. And I was very fascinated with that. I've taken pictures. George saw them, you know, the video I took of it. Very interesting. And then underneath this Sphinx, now this is what the book is about. I don't know how far below that Sphinx, but in the mountain beneath it, you know, I don't want to say 30 meters, that might be too little, but it's maybe more like 300 meters, but there is a chamber, according to this book, that is filled with holographic technology. It would be a hall of records as we would know it. And of course, when we think of the hall of records in Egypt, it evokes thoughts of papyrus and secret writings.
Right.
Well, this is far more spectacular than anything papyrus or secret writings might suggest. It's a holographic hall of records, whereby Radu explains that if you put your hand over a table, which is 6 feet high, it'll read out your DNA. If you put your hand closer to the table, it'll give you a more microscopic reading of your DNA. And if you put your hand over another part of the table, or another table perhaps, I don't remember how it works, you'll get the readout of what an alien species would look like. If you put the hands over both at the same time, you'll get a combination of those genetics. And what we have right there is a great theme for science fiction. Whether his story is true or not, it's expanding our capacity to think and compute.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's another aspect where he says if you go to one table, you will get it will resonate with your own DNA, who you are biologically, and give you a readout of history up to around the time 500 AD. After that time, it cuts off, which they attribute to a requiring a software update. It also explains in holographic image that this entire plateau of where Romania sits and the Wallachia, the region south of Transylvania, how it could be flooded or protected from water, from disaster, and it seems to be maintaining this territory of the earth in a certain form so it can release this information at some time in the future. This whole thing is a time release program, which the professors at Atlanticron, which there are many professors there from the University of Bucharest and whatnot, that explained to me that Atlanticron is named after Atlantis and Kron, which means the time of Atlantis. Kron is time. And that this is a reawakening of the ancient Atlantean modality, culture, calendar. And this is what all of this represents. But as I sit there and talk to these about these people that I visit with, they're not as into the zest of what I'm talking about. They know of the, some of them know about the story, some of them don't, some of them have read it. It's kind of like what I'm talking about is kind of lurking in the background to them. And it's kind of interesting that my zeal as a writer and somebody who's interested in this stuff is far exceeds their capacity to, you know, seek it out.
So when you visited the Sphinx, you saw it from the outside.
Yes, I did not see. I actually asked David when he called me before I went. He says, "What would you like to see?" I said, "I want to see the Hall of Records." And he's writing it, noting it down. Okay, Hall of Records. He sends an email to, he says, "Okay, my people will contact Radu." Now what happens is his people contact Radu. What happens is it goes to my publisher. And my publisher is the only contact to Radu in the regular world. And they don't even talk. I think they've talked by phone once. They talk by secret courier. And and he uses a phone card, a prepaid phone card. So Radu is very mysterious. Mm-hmm. Nobody, to my knowledge, has seen him. David thought that he might appear at Atlanticron. I don't think he did. I invited him to come last year. He said that he couldn't because he communicates to me by email. He said that he couldn't. There was too much security. He'd like to meet me in the United States, which he has been to. He was just here. He said he was very close to my house. He wrote to me. He says, but he did not come because he didn't want to cause me problems. He said that a lot of problems have arisen because of the release of his books in Romania.
So how did he talk to you about the information that's in this book? By email?
Well, this book was written in the Romanian language.
Oh,
it was translated into English. It was translated into Euro-English, and then I translated it into American English, which isn't a whole lot difference, but he said I did a very good job. There were certain points that were, you know, idioms and whatnot that don't quite work out.
Well, Peter, let me ask you this. How is he, how are you allowed to be a part of all this information, and why would Radu contact you?
Why did he choose you?
Yeah.
Well, the one thing is, Radu, and actually there's a person in his book who's far more interesting than Radu, and that's his superior, who he calls, his name is, and I assume these guys are pseudonyms for these people, Cesar Brad. And Cesar was a born psychic. He was brought up under the tutelage of Romania's Department Zero, which was in communist times originally, which was overseen by a doctor from China, Dr. Zhen, and who understood these metaphysical matters. And so Cesar is Radu's boss. And, of course, they had both become aware of the Montauk Project when it was published in Actually, I think they became aware of it before it was published in Romania. They had read it in English back in the 80s, and they were very interested in it. And I think when he found his publisher, who was a pretty young guy who just got into the business, he told me the story. I forget the exact story because I met the publisher, but it just started his whole publishing business. So he just, as a logical consequence that he's publishing my book, says, well, do you want to publish my book? That's kind of how it happens. Because, you know, they have the book, they want to sell it, they want to publish it, but it's more to make the information known. Now, it was very important that they made the information known in Romania, because what happened in the discovery of this chamber is, you know, the brown stuff hit the fan, literally, because it was... The Americans were the ones that enabled them to get the technology to be able to penetrate it. This chamber was discovered by the Pentagon with ground-penetrating radar through satellite technology, which there's the David connection again, you know, even if by just, because he had to deal with satellites. And
right.
they discovered this chamber, And in this chamber, there was no access to it by ordinary means. So they said, how does this chamber exist, and how come you can't get to it? They just saw it as a hole. I don't know what they saw in there. I don't know how sophisticated their ground-penetrating radar is, but they saw there was an anomaly there. So they had a representative contact Cesar Brad, the head of their secret department, Department Zero, which only answers to the president, and of Romania. And this go-between was a Italian Freemason who claimed to be one of the players in the Bilderberger group. And he said, he told him about the chamber. He says, you know, we want you to help us. We will offer you many great things. And Caesar saw these people as conspiratorial fools that were very evil, but he had no choice but to enter an alliance with them, or otherwise he would have been removed. And actually, the way it worked out was, it was kind of a trade-off. And the Americans supplied the technology, the Romanians had the territorial territory, and they penetrated this area in 2003 and opened it up more or less around the biorhythm of the Montauk Project, 2003. We were all wondering what was going to happen 20 years from the Montauk Project in 2003, and it was the opening of this chamber. We didn't know it at the time, what went on. We know that there was a blackout in New York State, August 14th, 2003, which Al Bielek had predicted, but there was something else going on in the mountains of Romania. So this incredible discovery was done behind the president of Romania's back. The Italian Freemason said, do not tell the president. This is part of our conditions. We don't want you, we don't want to disturb the political forces. When they opened, according to the story, when they opened up the chamber in underneath the Sphinx in Romania, it set off an alarm bell in a similar chamber, which the Americans had already discovered near Baghdad, you know, which is gives you a good reason for why the Americans were really in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
and why they ramrodded to get Saddam Hussein out of there and violate international law and that sort of thing.
Jim Mars, who did the, I don't know if you've read his work, but Rule by Secrecy, Alien Agenda, JFK, but he told us that back in 2004 or 2005 when he had him on last,
yeah.
when he said this, that the reason for the invasion was not at all for, for the oil or whatever it was. It was to go. It was because Saddam Hussein had these Sumerian tablets, and had broken the code. They found that he had broken the code for antimatter, right? And this was what George Bush was all excited about, and all his weapons of mass destruction and all this kind of stuff. That it wasn't really so much weapons of mass destruction as it was the key to it was the formula for antimatter. As well as for all of the information and the Sumerian tablets that were involved with the Anunnaki and different things, and the aspect of that was what made that interesting was he said that was their reason for that, as well as for their reason of destroying the museum, looting the whole museum, and taking the destroying any of the
artifacts.
Archaeological aspects or areas in there where they've actually paved over entire Sumerian foundations, areas
excavated
areas,
yeah.
And put landing fields and bases on these things. They totally destroyed the history there, purposefully, So
that's an extensive operation. They've done similar things in Turkey, in Bulgaria, I've heard.
That's possible.
From my friends in Bulgaria. But there was also some very fanciful stuff written in the, I forget the name of the journal. It was used to be called the Phoenix Journal. Rick Martin was the writer he reported on, stargates being found underneath Baghdad. And these are a separate storyline than what I'm talking about here. They're all of the storylines, including the one I'm telling, are not verifiable in their entirety. Mm-hmm. In their entirety, they're interesting stories. What I'm talking about here would make the tablets look, you know, insignificant by comparison, because
right.
we have a holographic memory.
Oh,
but what was interesting, and what is one verifiable tangential connection to this actually being real is if I continue the story from that point, is
Go
in
ahead.
Baghdad, the Americans had found this similar chamber with the similar holographic mumbo-jumbo. And basically, when the Americans had penetrated in with the Romanians in the Bucegi Mountains underneath the Sphinx, it set off an alarm in the chamber in Iraq, which basically showed them that somebody was penetrating the chamber in Romania. And the people on the job, the military personnel, which would probably look something like that Stargate TV show, called the Pentagon, or the other channels in the Pentagon, because they obviously weren't the same factions, called their military superiors. It went back to the White House
right.
and saying, what the heck's going on here? And then the president looked into it, or the president's people, and said, what are our people doing in Romania? And the American, whoever was doing this in the Pentagon, got caught. And the president, of course, communicated through diplomatic channels to the president of Romania. And this is what caused the big flap, because the president of Romania says, what's going on? Cesar, the head of Department Zero, had a boss, General Obadiah, who went and spoke to the president, and he basically explained why they did it secretly and covertly, and the president accepted it because he knew, he saw that the position they were in. Now, this caused a lot of tension between America and Romania as two countries, and the diplomatic tension is described in the book. It was very furious, and it was very tense, but what came out of it was a bridge between Romania and America, which is incredible. You'll see it in the paper if you go back and read the paper, the diplomatic relations that ensue from that, and then Romania is eventually a member of NATO. Now, they were a communist bloc nation, and all of a sudden, after this incident in 2003, when this chamber was allegedly discovered, you see these harmonizing of American and Romanian relations. When the publisher published it in Romania, he was contacted by several Romanian intelligence officials who had retired, who knew bits and pieces of the story, and said that as best as they knew, this story is probably true because XYZ is true and XYZ is true. So that it was verified on many levels by former intelligence people just in his experience.
I have a question about the alarm that went off.
Yep.
That alarm that went off, was that a modern alarm system?
Well, when I say alarm, I describe it as an alarm. I don't know that it was like a red ambulance light. I know that it was a, you know, some sort of like light, and then this thing appeared, which was a holographic image of what was going on, a map in Romania with a similar thing. I mean, he describes it in the book. I don't remember how well clearly he describes it, but certainly it was a letting them know that something was going on in Romania.
How long do you think these governments knew about this?
Obviously, well,
the government has known about it for a long time.
Well, you know, I don't know what they knew about Iraq. I don't know. I mean, how long they knew, if it goes back to the first, you know, Persian Gulf War. I really don't know what they know and when they know it. It's hard to say because there's so much infinite secrecy with the government and secret societies. What's interesting about this book is that this, when Caesar was a young boy, he was brought to a famous Orthodox priest named Arsenio Boca. Arsenio Boca, he was from Transylvania, and he predicted that this young man would be a crucial agent in great truths that were going to come to Romania. He saw it as a holy man, And he, you know, and then the Vatican got involved, and they had predictions. There was information in the Vatican, I forget exactly what it says, it's mentioned in the book, that, and Pope John Paul acknowledged to the Romanians that this was a great secret. It's true to the best of his knowledge, but he would only ask that you wait to release the information until humanity's ready for it. So this is the old story we hear with the government and the War of the Worlds and the Martians coming through New Jersey. You know, the world's not ready for this information.
Right.
I have to wonder why David Anderson and Radu Sinemar and yourself, how or why have they decided to bring this information out now? And there must have been some declassification going on if that's the case, because if this stuff is so secret, all of a sudden it's coming out through your system, through you, or they've contacted you to bring it out. What's going on here?
What's the benefit of it?
Yeah, what's the benefit of them releasing this information? What's the benefit to them?
Well, I don't know that it definitely does not have a benefit to the control system. As Preston Nichols said to me, as we were, even before the first Montauk Project book was written, and as we sat in that old Total Health Network in Farmingdale, which George attended many times, it was like you felt the fire that they must have felt during the Revolutionary War, freedom to assemble. You know, I was even surprised we were allowed to assemble in that little meeting hall, which was very, you know, unusual, archaic place, you know. And Preston explained, he says, the government has lost control. They do not have a total control monopoly the way they used to. And they can only control so many things. He said they didn't want to kill him because he would become a martyr. And that would make too much. They've learned through the hard way that martyrs don't work. Now, in other words, they can't control. And he's always said there's factions in the government that want things to come out. There's good people in the government, and there's bad people in the government. So we're living in a time of the information age. Now, the best defense they have against me as a writer of information is I'm ignored virtually by any major mainstream media. And, you know, what having you broadcast me is great, but it's like a sand, you know, like sand on the beach. It's just a few pebbles.
Right.
So I know that and now we have so much information on this planet that we're inundated with it.
Yeah.
And what's the average citizen going to hear this story and go, what? You know, it's like nobody really, I mean, people will be interested, but basically you can say anything you want. You could read out the sex lives of people in Washington, and they don't even have to kill you. If you really have it, like the girl who got killed, then you, if you really have the down and dirty stuff, then you might get it. But basically they can just ignore you for the most part. It's very easy to ignore, and people are already somewhat brain dead.
Let me ask you this. What do you think the benefit of this Hall of Records could be to humanity?
Well, this is the most interesting prospect of the whole operation, is if this story is true,
mm-hmm.
and it offers a hope of potential technology that could just do incredible things. I mean, it could, and we're already reaching some amazing technological plateaus in our society right now with medical science regrowing, you know, cells and this sort of thing. This
Without
is like,
doubt.
Pardon?
Without a doubt.
Yes.
Even
so,
nanotechnology.
Exactly. Now, where this becomes very important is how is it distributed to humanity? Now, David said this year at Atlanticron, he says everything that comes out, and Preston has said the same thing, is technologically on the marketplace, such as a laptop. He says the government had this 20, 30 years ago. It's only released when the government allows it to be released. So
right.
We have a distribution issue in the Tree of Life, and this distribution issue is monitored by different forces, which we could say, if we wish, are natural forces, from a magical or occult perspective, I would call them jinn or genie. They regulate the continuum, so to speak, and they have a dark face and a happy face. It's like an angel and a demon on one side. They stand at the gateway. So this information is representative of a gateway of not only information, access technology, and who are we humans that sit here in our imperfect bodies using one-tenth of our capacity? We're sort of like the ape man, you know, in 2001 looking up at the monolith.
Probably true.
Yeah. So how are they, like, Fred, you said that the jinn, right? You said the jinn have been guarding this place. Is that correct?
Well, I was using that as a metaphor because, but that jinn shows up. I'm told that if you go down from the Sphinx and go what I believe is southwest, I'm not sure, but you know, from where you get off of the cable car and you turn left and go to the south or the back way, you will eventually hit a fence and military guard will be there and they will chase you away. That is, you know, I didn't explore that when I was there last year. I didn't go to the Sphinx this year. But I will check that out and try and get video footage if I go back to that locale.
Did you get into the Sphinx actually or no?
No, the Sphinx is just a rock on top of a mountain.
I mean, into that.
The penetration part would be through some road which you don't even see. I mean, you don't drive up to that area. You go by cable car. You can hike it if you're an incredible mountain climber.
Yeah.
But if you're just a casual foot walker, no, you don't take that path. Now, what the back roads are around this little village of Bushtan or Bushtani is, you know, you'd have to know your way about it, and I'm sure there's a blocked-off military road that goes to the access point.
Talk a little bit about the gold reserves in Romania.
Well, as I was there this year, going into the heart of Transylvania to a sacred, we call it Transylvanian Stonehenge, which is a astronomical clock that they have that was built or at least kept up during the period of the Thracians or Dacians, as we would call them in American speak, an ancient ruins that still to this day have an astronomical clock. This is in an area, it's called Sarmizegetuza, but the area around it is known to be filled with gold. The taxi driver, as he took us there, pointed out to the mountain, he said, that mountain's filled with gold. I couldn't tell you exactly which one it was. And this is known about, and nobody minds you poking around. If you went in there with sophisticated equipment, you're going to arise to get attention. And I've heard, I don't know a lot about this, but I've Radu says that there's enough gold in this mountain that would completely turn the economy of Romania right side up because it's having a hard time and would also create a big change in the economic conditions of the world. There's so much gold there. Now, the stories are that if you try and get the gold, there's elemental forces. Here's your jinn coming into play, which will thwart you. So it's there for whoever's supposed to have it, sort of like I think the dragon guarding the gold or whatever, guarding jewels or whatever he was in that novel, The Hobbit.
Or it may not be just as you think it's going to be. When they say there's gold there, maybe it's not the way you think it is. Maybe it's not just loaded with gold coins and gold bars. It might be integrally involved in that mountain or in something.
That's a good point. I mean, I really don't know. It's a mystery. There's four other books that Radu has published in Romanian, and I've not been able to read them because they haven't been translated. And unfortunately, my publisher is not communicating with me, which I haven't heard from him in a long time. He's relayed letters to Radu, and I write to him. I say, well, you know, let's tell me the money you owe me so I can pay you the money I owe you.
And, that'd be nice, huh?
And I don't hear him. I don't hear from him. Which, and then I have friends in Bulgaria that want to publish his book, and, you know, he'll make some money from that. He doesn't communicate. So I'm saying is he must be very busy. I would think he's very busy because he's publishing, you know, I think he's published all sorts of esoteric books, metaphysical books that are popular here and in England. He's published them in Romania, and I think he's, you know, his business is more quantity than quality in terms of it's a quantity business. So he could be, you know, he was running the business by himself. So I don't know why he's not communicating, but I would like to get.
Are you able to get books from him, or just not? I mean you're published.
I printed the book in English, so I have my Transylvanian Sunrise. His book was called The Enemy Inside. I changed the name to Transylvania Sunrise. It's a better title.
Yeah.
And he's got, you know, three other books that I want to, you know, negotiate with him to get the rights.
Well, I hope that happens. That sounds like it's going to be a fascinating read, and I know if, can you tell our listeners how they could get that if they want it?
Yeah, it's skybooksusa.com. They can go to the website, www.skybooksusa.com, and they can also order it from Amazon.
Okay.
And that's how they can get the book, Transylvanian Sunrise. There's a order the book right off. I think it's the front page, but you can poke around the website and find it there.
Okay, let's talk a little bit in the time that we have left about the Montauk Book of the Living, which has also just been released and is a very interesting book. And in that you talk about the Amazonian blue race, the occult biochemistry of that race. Can you talk a little bit about that in the time we have left?
Sure. How much time do we have left?
We have about
13
minutes.
Okay.
We stopped streaming, yeah.
All right, I'll give it the 13-minute version. Okay, this was a series of...
If you let me just interrupt. I want to just acknowledge Anthony here for 1 second. He joins
us. We have a caller, so...
So he may have a question, if that's okay. We'll try to keep it brief here so you can explain the Book of the Living. Hello, Anthony. Did you want to join us?
Oh, that's fine. I'm just on my way home from the gym, and I'm listening.
Okay.
The Transylvanian Sunrise looks like this full moon that I'm looking at right now, but go ahead.
Okay,
Peter, go ahead. The Montauk Book of the Living he's talking about and the occult biochemistry of the Amazonian blue race.
Right. This was a culmination. This book took me 12 years to write based upon investigations I'd had subsequent to publishing The Pyramids of Montauk, which was about an ancient, the Montauk Indians who occupied the land where the Montauk Project took place. They were taken off the land. There was a lot of synchronicities I discovered surrounding these Montauk Indians who were known as pharaohs. And they traced their lineage back to Egypt, which also traces back to Atlantis. And Atlantis had a blue queen who's made fun of in the 1920 movies. Her name is Antinea. And all of these synchronicities revolved around their modern-day matriarch who died as she was sent to the hospital the day she received my Pyramids of Montauk book in the mail, and her name was Olive Farrell. Now, all of these synchronicities tied around Olive, the pharaohs, and Queen Antinea, who it turns out is the inspiration for Athena. Antinea was transliterated into Athena by the Greeks, and she gave mankind the olive. Now, the olive is is basically the synchronicities that I follow in this book. And the olive, Egypt was known as the land of the olives. The Mount of Olives, there's a spot, a church on the Mount of Olives where Christ is supposed to have ascended from,
right.
And they have his footprint there. And it was a fight over that church, which made the Crimean War, which formed the boundaries of Romania, amongst other things. So it all ties in together, these two books. But back to your question about occult biochemistry of, you know, it's a pretty popular subject. When I originally published it in The Black Sun, it was not so popular except for the this guy named David Hudson had done this whole New Age scam where people were scammed to buy investments that he was going to make this occultum or white gold. I don't know what he called it, mana from heaven. And the subject is the white gold was something in Egypt that you would consume from mummies or from, you know, or you would produce it in your own brain biochemistry. It had to do with the eating of the dead, the mummies. And this is part of the cannibalistic practice of Christianity, which is eating the, you know, blood and body of the Savior.
Right.
If it's not cannibalism, well, it's based upon cannibalism, eating a body. And so this was to enlighten all the pathways of your brain, which, you know, we're using 10% of our brain. The whole idea is your whole brain lights up. And there was this white gold was also found in the chamber in Romania. Now, this goes into some
of
the...
Is that manna from heaven?
It's the same substance. The same substance. This has been dealt with, and most of the stuff that's been talked about, in my opinion, is disreputable, that you'll find people, you know, more interested in selling this substance. Are they really getting enlightened? No, the best stuff you can produce is through your own biochemistry and your own, you know, your brain, your body can produce practically anything. It can produce anything. That's a real pathway. I think when they started taking it external and eating it from their ancestors, I think this was a degenerate pathway that led to the dissolution of their culture rather than making it themselves in the temple mysteries that they performed.
There is a product called monatomic gold, and it's a natural substance. And David Icke, I don't know if you're familiar with David Icke.
Of course.
Well, David Icke has it on his website. He sold it for many, many years on his website. I've never really bought it.
No, you don't want it. You want to stay away from that stuff. In fact,
that's called atomic gold or something. And I said, and that's the same thing that Jim Mars was saying. It was called monatomic gold, but it wasn't the same stuff.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But he said what it was is this is what they found in Iraq, and this is what they discovered. They found the formula for it, and what it is it's antimatter. And they said when you put it into a container, the container weighed a third less than when you didn't have it in there to begin with, you know, before you put the substance in there. So in other words, this was the formula that they discovered, that Saddam Hussein had possession of, and this is what they wanted to go in and get, supposedly.
Well, anyway,
I don't know.
It would be the gold and the monatomic gold and this kind of thing, which was close to matter. Why though wouldn't you want to get that monatomic gold from David Icke?
Well, because I had a friend who did a study on it, and his Nova Alchemia, I think it was, Raul from Austria. He grew up studying. You know, he was like grew up being a practical chemist, breaking down rocks ever since he was a kid. And he looked into some of this stuff and some of the monatomic. And I can't speak exactly for the stuff that David. I didn't know he was selling it, but I thought he just referred to it.
It's one of his sponsors there, so he's been doing.
Whatever. He warned me about most of the stuff on the market is actually potentially dangerous to you. I don't speak for it. I don't take any of these substances. I have a Qigong teacher I respect greatly, and he has tested certain stuff muscle tested, and it has been beneficial. But I don't know which ones are good and which ones are not. The most interesting thing about the stuff in Romania is it had a different chemical bonding than any other described. He said it was unique. Now, this was found in a jar. Now, I really can't speak for it. I've had people say made wild claims about the white gold, and I would attribute them to just wild claims. I have spoken to somebody who I also trust who took genuine stuff she got in Egypt from the people there and said, it sounded to me sounded a little bit to me like cocaine, actually.
Oh, yeah. It does, doesn't it?
Like they got an instant flash or rush. Now, I'm not saying it was cocaine, but it's basically something you want to continually. And my friend in Austria said that basically all this stuff, it takes a long time for it to work. So, you know, if it's not doing destructive things or negative things, it's going to take a long time to really get benefit with these things. And
well, I always wondered what manna from heaven was anyway. I mean, because it always came, supposedly, I mean, in the Bible, it always came, you know, it came down to the people it fed the Jews and the
devil. Right.
But they never really described it. It almost sounded like a bread, you know, or of some sort, or bread-like snowflake.
Well, that's what you thought.
That's what they described it as, kind of like a bread or which was manna, you know.
Well, I will say something about bread. Bread was also in Rome, or Latin, it's called pan.
Right.
And Jesus was identified as pan, you know.
Okay.
And pan, you know, so pan... Pan, the god, that you know, that, and because Tiberius was told at the exact moment Jesus is supposed to have died, the great Pan is dead.
Oh.
And this disturbed Emperor Tiberius. It was like it really hurt him. You know, of course, that was a Roman god, Pan. And,
that was the Pan of, Pan was the satyr, basically.
He was half man and half beast.
Yeah, that, well, that's one version, yeah. And Pan is, of course, is the name for bread. So when you say, you know, you're eating pan, you're eating bread, you're eating Jesus, you're eating the Eucharist, which represents the you know, enlightenment, it even goes into, I did an etymology in one of my books on Golgotha, which is the skull. It's the enlightenment of the skull, because the goal is like the gold, the goal and the goal and the Gotha. It's supposed to mean head, you know, skull. But it also represents the illumination of the skull. So, you know, there's a lot of esoteric correspondences in the Bible, which one of my Moorish friends had said that the name Bible, Holy Bible, comes from Helios Biblos. It means the book of the sun. It was a book of astrology. And that the Bible we have today is a diluted version of what was once a much bigger and greater book that has been translated through various means and is not always. So when we say bread, really, what were they really saying? Were they saying sustenance? Were they saying pan? This is better left for scholars. And then there's the work of Stan Tenen, which takes these even to more geometric metaphors for the Bible.
Huh. Getting back to the Montauk Bach Book of the Living, you talk about the biological truth behind the virgin birth.
Well, we've only got a few minutes, but I'll say it in a nutshell,
is that...
There is a female ejaculatory liquid, which only 3% of women experience regularly, scientifically. Another 14% will experience it sometime in their life, and the rest of women don't. And this scientific ejaculatory liquid called moonflower by tantrists and Taoists, they call it moonflower, was not scientifically recognized until the 80s, although... You know, people in ancient Greece talked about it. Now, when I found out about it through a Tantra teacher, my friend Tantra Bensko, it's basically has the same constituency as sperm. So, in other words, and it changes biochemically with what you take, what food you take, what regimens you do. So it would stand to reason that the Virgin Mary, who belonged to an Essene cult, would have been prepared to have in a very special way, and that she could have either impregnated herself or been impregnated by another type of sperm or moonflower.
Yeah. I always thought it was possibly the extraterrestrial or some other sperm, but that's fascinating that women. For some women, could actually be androgynous.
Well, but this is see, any woman can produce this. It's something that needs to be cultivated, and this also ties to the whole Jewish Kabbalistic tradition, which is the reason we have the universe the way it is because the feminine energy left, and this is part of bringing back the feminine energy. It's a matriarchal culture that used to produce this stuff, and as the patriarchy took over, it's sort of receded into the, you know,
yeah.
recesses of our culture, and this is a very important part of that book, and it falls like this stuff totally turns Christianity upside down, but it falls on dead ears because people are too, you know, conditioned to whatever they believe in, whether it be Oprah, Christianity, or some other, you know, stuff that fills their head.
And Peter, how could our listeners get this book, The Montauk Book of the Living?
The same way, skybooksusa.com. When I think there's some sample chapters of each book on there that you can read. I think one of them is the chapter on the quantum female as well, I believe it's on there. You can download and just read a free chapter and intro.
Yeah, okay. I was wondering, we've stopped streaming at this point, but we still have a little time. What I wanted to ask you was, it was still being recorded, by the way, but what I wanted to ask you is if you might be willing to join us on our Tuesday night show, our FM show, to discuss this.
Now, Tuesday night is, I get my calendar out.
Yeah.
This Tuesday, did you have in mind?
Yeah, Tuesday night at 9:30, we'd like to have you on, 9:30 to 10. That's our FM show. It's a, we've got a much larger listening audience with that one.
Yeah. I'd certainly like to. I think the 8th, I think, is quite agreeable. You know, the next week I couldn't do it, but the 8th is the day after Labor Day.
Yeah, that's right.
That would be quite fine.
Okay, we will call you at 9:30. Well, we'll actually call you before and let you know.
9:30 in the evening?
9:30
yeah.
in the evening. Would that be all right?
That would be fine. Now, but I have a question for both of you. I mean, I don't remember your name and the lady. I think... I don't remember. I mean, we've been talking, but I didn't hear who your names were.
The line, and hasn't said anything all night. Hasn't told you who we are.
I'm Lila, and he's Leo.
Leo and Mila?
Lila.
Lila and Leo, yeah.
Lila.
Lila,
right.
Yes.
Oh, God.
Hey. Maybe that's my fault. I should have explained.
Huh?
It's okay. I didn't know, if we'd spoken before, I didn't remember, so.
Okay.
Yeah, you were on a show about a year ago talking about the Spandau mystery.
Okay.
Well, we had a little bit of advantage over you. We were looking at the Montauk Pulse, the special
right.
edition, and of course it has your name all over it, so it made it easy for us.
Yeah, but George has talked
and George
to us.
And George has
we,
also
we
talked
know
to us
you
about
are,
you.
But the odd thing was is that, we'd love to have you on Tuesday night, if you could. We'll call you, we'll talk more about this if you'd like.
No, that'll be fun. It'll be great. I enjoyed doing it.
It was a very interesting discussion, and we'll talk a little more about these things.
What I'd like it if you could if you send me your addresses.
Okay.
And the email skybooks@yahoo.com, I will send you copies of the book.
Okay.
Oh, okay, that's great.
It's the least I can do.
Okay,
right.
That'd be good. And we can call you and we can give you that.
What happened?
Now, are you located in Manhattan?
No, we're in Connecticut.
Whereabouts?
Salisbury.
I don't know where Salisbury, Connecticut is.
That's in the northwest corner. It's on the border of Massachusetts and New York.
Yeah, Georgia.
Okay, all right.
Many times.
Yeah.
But anyway, we'd like to let you know, we'll talk to you on Tuesday night, and possibly I can maybe talk to you before then.
We'll talk to you
and
before then. Give us, we'll give you our address and all that kind of thing. We'll talk to George and get your number.
Okay.
Okay. You want my phone number now, or?
Oh, no. We're still on the air. We're being recorded here. So.
Oh, okay. All right.
I'll talk to you later, all right?
Okay, Leo.
Thank you so much. And
thanks,
George,
Lila. Thanks, George.
Thanks for everything, Peter.
Okay.
And Anthony, we appreciate your being with us as well. So, good night, and
thanks for listening, folks.
Yeah.
Good night.
What was the gentleman's name?
Peter Moon.
Oh, Peter Moon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, that's ironic. It's such a beautiful
author of the month
full moon.
Project.
Okay. Beautiful full moon tonight. Have y'all seen it?
No.
Hey, it's Peter.
Beautiful.
Sir.
No, he's gone.
I easily left. Yeah. George, you're still with us?
Yes.
Okay, and Anthony's with us, right?
The beautiful moon.
Yeah, you know what's bizarre, Anthony. I don't know if you noticed this one, but they kind of clear the board they kind of clear the switchboard of numbers and everything.
Yeah, they do.
Well, the call. I don't know why they do that.
Blog Talk's gotten a lot bigger, so they probably clear things out so other people have opportunities to get on.
Yeah.
But it says, but they're not showing, they're not recording anymore. They don't record the show after, it says that they just clear the board out. I don't know what happened. It doesn't matter.
Oh, well.
Oh, well.
Well, that was an absolutely fascinating discussion. I can't wait to hear the rest of the archives.
Oh, good. Well, you'll be on in the archives here. So, and also, if you want to join us Tuesday night, you can pick us up on WQQQ.com at between 8 and 10 o'clock, and Peter will be on at 9:30.
Great.
Okay, so WQQQ.com. We'll have that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well,
thank you. Have a great night, you all.
All right, Paul. And thank you, Anthony, and thank you, George, for everything. And Peter, if you're still there, thank you.
Pleasure.
Okay. Talk to you later. Good night.
Good night.